But that winter, I used to play rugby on a Saturday, and then on Sunday morning, I used to get this phone call from Kepler. Let's go and meet down at the nets. And every Sunday morning, I used to throw and bowl. And then, I mean, he probably won't ever listen to this podcast, but he had the poofy little arm, okay? So after throwing to him for nearly an hour and bowling to him for nearly an hour, I used to get half an hour of these little poofy throws at me, you know, like that.
Welcome to The Biggest Man in Cricket with your host, David Brooke.
We are here in St. Francis in the Eastern Cape. It's a beautiful morning here, and we are at the home of a legend of the South African cricket, a legend of the game, an inspirational figure in South African sport. It's an absolute privilege to be sitting here with Dave Calhoun. Dave, welcome to The Biggest Man in Cricket.
Thank you.
Dave to Dave, and it's fantastic to be here. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Loving living here. I've lived here for the last 2 years permanently. So it's been a major change. I've had a few small health issues in the last couple of years. So I was boarded from work, basically. And I think they did me a favor. I've been able to now live here without having to drive in and out of town. And you know, we've still got a small business in town, my wife and I, an embroidery business. So we still move in between PE and F. My daughter's in PE. So, yeah, so far so good. But, yeah, welcome. I've watched some of your podcasts and followed you, you know, since the SA20. So it's been good to meet you in person, put it that way.
Thanks very much for having us. It's absolutely brilliant to be here. Have you ever not lived in the Eastern Cape?
Yeah, when I finished playing cricket in 2003-04 season, at the end of that season, I was convinced to go down and work for a Cape Town based company.
Okay.
And we moved to the Cape for about 3 years.
Okay.
Eventually, it's a long story. We eventually moved back to the Eastern Cape. You know, it wasn't nothing to do with the Cape. We loved the Cape. As a family, it was probably at the right time. We did so much on weekends together. But obviously, work-wise, it wasn't ideal for me. You might have heard of the company called Fidentia.
Okay.
I was fortunate to get out of that old mess about a year before it actually went belly up.
Oh, wow.
So, and I got out and came back, and yeah, I was manager of Pam Golding Properties for about 3 years as well, until Andrew decided to sell the office and make it a franchise.
Okay.
Which you might, interesting to you, knows that Justin Craish, the ex-cricketer.
Yes, it's ex-Warriors cricketer.
He ended up buying the franchise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I then moved on and joined the bank, you know, for the last 14-odd years.
Former cricketers, you either work for the Nashuas, a bank, or you know, one of those kind of guys.
Yeah.
So you've followed a similar path.
Yeah,
eh?
And I've always, look at the most important. We've always had a little business on the side. So it's always sort of our own as such, and it's diversified. The income coming in a little bit, but it's now it's solely a. Solely that. We've put a lot of effort into that business, it's been good.
And you're enjoying a bit of golf? I know you like
golf. I love my golf. I still only play once a week. I'm still trying to get through this mentality to try and play twice a week. You know, like it just doesn't fit well. Like I should be at work. I should be doing something. I should be trying to make some money.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me. I haven't found that.
You I've haven't completely golf retired.
I can't get that completely retired feeling into me. Yeah. It's almost that guilty feeling.
Yeah, you know? I know what you mean. And hopefully I'll get there one day. But, when we were coming up to PE for some recordings, there seems to be a lot of the legends that are still based here. You know, they've traveled the world, they've done various jobs either within cricket or not, but somehow the guys land up back here. What is it about this place? Me coming from Cape Town, what is it about this place that...
Yeah, I think every place has its... If you're brought up here,
yeah,
you know, you will always... Most of your families are here.
Yeah.
I think I know who you're referring to, the guys like the Pringles and those sort of guys. They love hunting. They love fishing. So that's all very accessible when you're living in this part of the world, you know. So, yeah. And it's just, it's still got that sort of small town. You know, we don't have these long queues or traffic jams and stuff and that type of thing. Yeah. So you get around pretty quickly, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, from here to P is 100 Ks, I think. Yeah. It is, yeah, on the dot. Yeah. Takes me an hour every morning when I do have to go to town.
Mm.
So, and there's lots of us here, lots of us in the area that do it, you know. So
AD Burrell has actually spoken quite a bit about that kind of, you know, he's a local guy here.
Yeah.
He does obviously travel around the world and stuff, but Eddie's spoken about the spirit that comes in the Eastern Cape here, and that is filtered through to the Sunrise Eastern Cape in SA20. Yeah. And there's, you know, the local guys and stuff. When you, is that correct? You know,
I mean, Eddie's a good friend of mine, and we've got a little group with myself, Mark Rushmere, him and Dave Ferrant, who's also a left-arm spinner for EP and Free State for a while. And we talk quite a lot on our little WhatsApp group, and we used to get together for coffee, you know, whenever he's back from Hampshire or you know, not involved with the Sunrises. And that whole family culture has always been here. I mean, even going back to the EP days when we first started, when Kepler arrived here, the one thing that Kepler did in the late 80s, 90s was to get that sort of family environment going. You know, and we were such a close team, a lot of local guys, and one or two professionals. But we, after practice, we used to go fishing together, and, you know, we used to bride together on a Sunday if we weren't playing. So there were a lot of things that we did. We'd go away for weekends together. We used to come out to Mark Rushmere's place on the river here. So there were a lot of that sort of culture. You know, that's what we
brotherhood did, almost, brotherhood rather than thing.
And that's, I think, where AD's got it, you know. Mm. So he's just taken it and put it into the Sunrises. And, I mean, you would have followed some of the team-building exercises.
Yeah.
There's no fancy stuff in some high-end game reserve or whatever it is. His uncle owns a farm, game farm was involved with a game farm down the road. Beautiful game farm. And they'll just go there and they'll have braais together and they'll go and do their thing together, and that just brings that nice culture, you know, that he's developed.
It's quite a unique skill, that, because you're sitting in these franchises, and it's all about glitz and glam and it's all about money and stuff, but taking it back to its roots, down to kind of team culture and environment and creating an organic culture, is something that you don't see in this modern age of cricket. I mean, you look at that going like, we had something similar back in the day like that. I mean, that must be cool for you guys to see that.
No, it's brilliant. I mean, you know, if you think about it, I've often thought about it. I would have said, when I retired from cricket, a lot of people have said to me, you know, why didn't you go into full-time coaching? You know, like, and I often think about it and I think it would have been great. But at this now, the way I was brought up and how we played the game, it would be, and I've probably been out the game for a while now in that way, it would have been very hard for me to understand the culture of some of these teams and manage some of these players. Some of these are multi-million rand players that fly in for 6 weeks, do a job and move on. But AD's had that ability to make them part of the team or feel part of the team.
Yeah.
And it was, I thought maybe it was because of Markram as well, as the first captain of Sunrisers. But I mean, Tristan Stubbs has taken over and he's done a wonderful job. And so you have to look back and say to AD, well done, you know, you've brought these guys in, you've made them part, they're part of Port Elizabeth. They only talk about Port Elizabeth and the Sunrisers, or Klaverge, if they want to call it now. So it's been brilliant. Yeah, they've done very well.
I think Tristan is, you know, Tristan's made a lot of money in his very young age from franchise cricket, but he, whenever I talk to him, he is the most grounded PE boy that you could possibly find.
So I, I've had the privilege, and I don't really, but my son and him were at school together at Gray. And I was actually, for 7 years, from 2013 through to 2020, 21, I actually coached at Gray. So I had Bretzky coming through, I had Sir Pamela coming through in my teams, and I had and Tristan. So I've been involved a lot with in the not
it
the
makes
main
complete
coach,
sense.
just in the background. So yeah. I've got to know Tristan like one of my sons. You know, yeah. he's come here a few times, and like you said, he is the most grounded kid that you would ever think. Made a lot of money, obviously. And making lots of money, but the most grounded kid. And him and Matthew's developed into a very, very good cricketer as well. Very good mind, cricket mind. So both of those kids have done us proud from a great point of view.
I was going to say, from a generation point of view, the city, the town, it must be very proud when you see, and I think that's what Sunrise has got right. In that they recognize that local is lekker, local is key.
Yeah.
You know, to see that, and I want to ask you briefly about the SA20. And you see, you played in an era where St. George's was packed on a domestic game on a regular basis, let alone a international game. But to see what South African cricket has gone through in the last maybe 10 years and in the last 3 or 4 years of SA20, from somebody that's been there and played in a packed crowd, how good is it to see St. George's like that again?
Yeah, I mean, I went to the Sunrisers Mumbai Indians game at the end of the season. And I sitting here, I get the goose flesh thinking about it. I took a photograph sitting at looking at the Duck Pond Pavilion and the ground and the lights and everything. And it just brought me back so many memories of the times, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, where, you know, we filled out crowds, you know, filled out the ground on a Wednesday night, on a Friday night, it was packed. And it was just so nice to see. I mean, I've even taken the pictures of my laptop screensaver, you know what I mean? Because it was such a nice evening, you know, the weather was great. You know, the team has done so much for the community. Yeah. It's just unbelievable what it's done for cricket in the area. You know, I just hope we can maintain that and grow it even further, you know.
Do you think that's filtered down to, I know you're involved with Old Grey, do you think it's filtered down to the clubs and the schools that kids are getting into asking their parents to go and buy them cricket kit now?
Do you know, most definitely. I you know, I'm still one or two of the social media channels. I've always taken a little bit of a step back from Old Grey because I live here, but I still help on an advisory basis when I can. My name still appears on some of the social media as the chairman, you know. And over the last few years, weeks, I get these phone calls or emails or WhatsApps, you know, can I join Old Grey? And it's amazing how many women have contacted or moms have contacted me because their daughter wants to play cricket,
right?
You know, and then I'll put them on to obviously the relevant coaches at the club and or the club manager or the club coach or whatever it is, and all those kids are now starting to play cricket again, you know.
Amazing.
And that is what you call growing the game.
100%.
You know what I mean? Because I don't know how much it has been growing for the before the SA20. I don't think it grew at all. I think it was shrinking very quickly. And the SA20s really revived cricket in South Africa.
It's great that sometimes the older generation, you know, are not appreciated as much as the biggest man in cricket appreciates the older generation. let's say it like that. So it is great to see that people like yourselves are going to it and you not sitting at home and just not being bitter, but just saying that not domestic cricket shit or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, no, look, I have a view, about a very strong view, and I get quite annoyed when I see the kids of today, or cricket today can't be any worse than it was when we played.
Mm-hmm.
There's no ways. You can't get guys practicing, going to the gym, practicing from 10 o'clock every morning, okay? You can't compare that to a guy, like when we were praying, my first half of my season, my first half of my career, not my end of my my first half, the guys that used to arrive at 4 o'clock and practice for an hour and a half and go for a beer afterwards. Okay. So you can't compare the generations in a way. You know what I mean? Most definitely, there were some standout players. Okay. Most definitely. I mean, you got the Rices and the Capers and the Pollocks and the Fotheringhams. I mean, that whole Mean Machine side, a lot of those guys, you know, and you go around to each team and you can pick out some of the stars. But the average player was not as good as the average player of today, put it that way. And it's impossible. I mean, these guys, gym in the morning, fielding practice, nets in the afternoon or vice versa, psychologists, all sorts of things, you know, physios, dietitians, you know.
The dietitian would never have worked back in the day.
No, I mean, I got a very good friend down in Plett, Duncan Brown and his brother Wayne, and their father was Pete Brown, who used to be the manager of United Tobacco Company, or okay, I think it was them, or whatever it is.
One of those.
But their brand was obviously B&H. And a couple of weeks ago, my daughter got married down there, and we were reminiscing, and we were talking about his dad, you know, and like I used to see Pete every Wednesday and Friday. He used to walk into the change room after the game and drop four cartons of V&H in the change room, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And all the students would dive in and grab all the smokes, you know, that type of thing. And two cases of beer in the middle of the change room,
it's unreal.
So now you go into a change room, you're not allowed to drink any alcohol for 2 hours or an hour afterwards. You've got all these ice bars.
Doping test,
You've got all these ice bars packed out and all sit there and do this. You know, so it's culture is different. The game's changed. You know what I mean?
You know,
so
that whole B&H, you know, that era, you know, your EP side was, you know, an unbelievable side. You look back at some of the names, the Rod McCurdy, those kind of guys, just like, give us one or two kind of like great stories about these kind of, not the, I mean, Kepler we'll talk about because he was obviously such a key figure. But maybe some of the other guys that were characters back in the day.
Yeah, we had, obviously there was Rod and Merrick in the early days. Brilliant guys, full of fun. One of my favorite stories, I think in those days we used to get a meal allowance. It was R27.50, okay?
And very specific.
And R27.50, when you stayed in a hotel, R27.50 could buy you a carvery at the hotel and maybe a soft drink. Wouldn't get you a beer. And we were, after every day's play or game, we were always very thirsty, you know, like we had to look for a beer for places. And we were sort of weren't paid the contracts that we had now and that. So money was always a little bit of an issue, you know. So we used to have a guy, you would have remembered him, Flam Micho.
Yes,
Oh, Flummy.
I've got his autograph in my autograph book. Yeah.
Flum was a legend, eh? So Flum could down a beer in less than a second. Okay. He had this ability to open up his throat and as quick as he could pour it went down. So wherever we went around the country, we used to find a pub, sort of a dodgy pub type place, where it had a nice steak. And then we'd go there and then Rod would Australians are synonymous with gambling. They love to gamble and bet. Okay, so Rod used to gear these guys up in the pub to challenge Flum on a down.
Yeah,
and he used to line them up 10 at a time. All used to put $10 on the table. Okay, and then he would go, and they'd all down, and Flum would win it. Then he'd take all the money and say, okay, guys, we can have a few more beers now.
That's great.
So, and this I went, and then Flum would go to the toilet, stick his finger down his throat, get rid of that beer. And then we'd wait for another hour or so. And if there was another challenge on, you get them all lined up. And this time, now there's more. It's not even 10. There's 15 to 20 oaks lined up. They've all put their $10 in.
Yeah.
Flum would go. Thank you very much. Then we were never short of money for
booze. That's great. And if ever he was looking to sign away, he's like, no, you're not signing for any other team. We need you here. That's some great story.
So we had some memorable times on those tours, especially with those guys. There's some real characters. You know, so.
Did Kepler, I mean, Kepler's a very serious character on the outside when we see him as normal fans, but Did he ever, I mean, was he good banter, and what did he get drunk, and did he, you know, did he indulge a little bit?
Kipler, we used to have we used to call them the milkshake brigade.
Okay.
So that was generally, it was Kipler.
Yeah.
Tim Shaw.
Okay.
Mark Rushmeff. Philip Am early on in his career, until he later found Esprit, flavored wine. So those are the sort of, we're called the milkshake brigade. So get back from the ground, we'd all go up into the hotel, and then we'd all leave to go to our pub, wherever it was. And then you'd always walk past the restaurant, and there would the generally four of them be sitting there having their carvery and their milkshake. But the good thing about them all was that Ann Kipler was at the end of the game, we used to always celebrate. Mm. You know, that was when we all went out together, and
nice.
Yeah. So Kipler,
You guys did it on day two. He was
We started the day before the games. So the one thing with Kipler, I remember, I used to share a room with Rod McCurdy, so that was like,
okay.
For me, it was like this. Nobody else wanted to, basically. So I had the honor of sharing with Rod, and I remember so many times Kipler coming saying to me this year, Dave, you know, please watch out for Rod, you know. No, watch out for Rod. Meanwhile, I was like joining in, you know, like having fun and that. Yeah. And then the one day, I think he realized that I was having too much fun. So he came to me and he said to me, listen, yeah, if you go out tonight and you come home late, all right, and if you ever let me down, okay, you won't play for EP again.
Hmm.
Okay, cool. Anyway, fast forward a little bit. A few years after that, just come back from my cancer story. I was asked as a guest speaker down in the waterfront in a big cancer function. There must have been, I don't know, 1,000 people in one of those halls there, or conference facilities there. And I'd give my testimony and chat to everybody. And they said, bring a few of the players.
Mm.
Okay. So I took a few players with me. They came with me. Kipler didn't come. Anyway, so now we go and the table, free wine, free everything. This is the day before the game. Okay. So now we indulged in a few glasses of wine. I wasn't too bad. Obviously, didn't have too many because I was talking, and I don't like to talk when I've had too many glasses of wine. But some of my players, they enjoyed the Cape wines. And anyway, so we arrive at the ground the next day, and it's overcast. And we win the toss, so we send Province into bat. Okay. And in about the fourth over, one of our bowlers, and I can't remember who it was. I think it was Alan Barden, or if I remember correctly. One of the bowlers got injured. And I think Kipler knew that the night before we'd had a few. And he threw me the ball and he said, bowl. And I had to run up into that southeaster. Okay. I bowled for the whole session. He bowled me the whole session. Okay. He didn't give me a break. Yeah. He wasn't going to let me down. So, we had some really good times.
Dave, I've actually, we have a partner for this episode. It's Take A Lot. It's Testicular Cancer Awareness Month. Mm. And we will get into your story in a bit. But they've delivered a box to us. It's creating awareness around testicular cancer and around effectively men checking their boxes.
We get
Take A Lot deliveries here.
Yeah, definitely.
In St. Francis, and we don't really check the box, we check what's inside. I will ask you to check what's inside, and we're going to have a bit of fun with what's inside the box. But throughout April, Take A Lot will be delivering these boxes around the country with a little bit of an indent on the outside to highlight what goes on with men and testicular cancer. So what I want to do, and you're talking about your teammates, your ex-teammates now, I want you to open the box, and there's a few items that are quite quirky and related. And I want you to talk about the first player that comes into mind that relates to whatever you find in the box. So I'll ask you to just open it.
So there's no warning.
No warning. One, yeah. So the bubble wrap is not part of it.
Okay. All right. Oh, no. Shame. Dave Richardson.
Okay.
Swigger.
Swigger.
Okay. Swigger with a mirror. That man was, he always dressed to the T.
Yeah.
Attorney.
Yeah.
Look, the whole lot. Everything's in place. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so I would, Dave Richardson would
brilliant.
Definitely.
Love that one. Love that one. Let me remove that. Next item.
Oh, my word. Shaver. I would have to go with, I would say Rod McCurdy. I don't know why I would. And the reason being, I don't know if you ever saw Roddy. I mean, he had hair, facial hair like you've never seen it before.
Yeah.
His chest hairs just stick out his shirt. Remember when the old days?
Could have done with one of those back in the day.
He could have done with one of these, you know.
Manscaper was not a popular thing back in the 80s and the 90s.
Definitely. Timer. I would have to give this to Philip M.
Philip M.
Yeah.
Mm. Why?
Yeah. He was probably never on time.
I love that. What were the fines back in the day? You know, these days they...
There was drinking fines.
Drinking fines.
Yeah, no, it wasn't money. We didn't have money to fine in monetary fines. It was drinking fines.
What else we got here?
Gee, what else we got here? Some Nivea. I would say Kenny McKeown.
Kenny McKeown, okay, yeah.
Such a clean living, good guy.
Nice.
Nice person.
Yeah.
Wonderful to share changing room with him. Still a good friend.
Amazing.
So.
Live here?
Yeah, he lives in Plett.
Okay.
And he's got friends here that from the ex-headmaster of Grey guy and, he was at Sachs, I think it is. Bishops?
Yeah.
Bishops?
Bishops, yeah.
Pearson. Guy okay. Pearson, and then the other brother, twin brother, was headmaster of Grey, and they live here, and they were both at Queen's with Kenny.
Okay, nice.
So Kenny comes here quite often. Yeah.
Amazing.
So I see him every now and again. Yeah.
What else do we got? There's a couple more items. Yeah, we got
tennis balls.
Yeah. I had a question of who is the one that wanted throwdowns for hours from the coach.
Oh, Kepler.
Yeah, I figured that was
Kepler. So I'll tell you a story about Kepler.
Yeah.
So I, in 87, was also playing rugby for EP.
Mm.
And then I just got back from my national service and Kepler wanted me to play cricket.
Mm.
But I was quite keen to follow a rugby career at the same time because during my national service, after playing for EP, I went and did my national service in Kimberley. And when I came back from Kimberley, guys like Mark Rushmere, Philip Am, this is just before, just about when Kepler was here, just arrived. Flamengo really had cemented their places in the team.
Mm.
And I was battling to get into the four-day team at that stage.
Mm.
But I was also playing rugby. And rugby was an amateur sport, but we used to go into the change room afterwards, and the manager used to walk around with a little brown paper packet, okay, and give you 300 rand if you won in a brown paper packet, and if you lost, and if you won, you got 400 rand, okay, and he would walk around and he would give everybody a little brown paper packet, and that would be your cash for the week. At that stage, cricket was a professional sport, so-called professional.
Mm.
And we were getting 100 rand a day and getting taxed on 100 rand. So rugby became quite attractive Kepler arrived. And then Kepler said to me, listen, I need you to flag cricket. Mm. You're going to get injured with those guys.
Yeah.
And look at it, really. I mean, those days. I mean, if you look at the rugby players of today, they are massive. I mean, I stood next to Jean de Villiers a few years ago and I looked at him and I thought, imagine facing that thing, it's like he's huge.
Not even the biggest guy.
No, he's not even the biggest. In our day, we had Fafa Kunutsa, Tony Watson, Hans Scriver, Chippie van Sail. Mm. I mean, I was bigger than them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So rugby was quite, you know, quite attractive. And I was offered a contract to go and play rugby in Italy with Nelly Smith, the coach.
Mm.
He asked guys, the guys that he asked were Stain Swart, Mario Swart and myself to go with him overseas. And help Italy rugby or play there and try and build it up. And when Kepler heard that, he nearly had a cadenza. So he said, no, look here, I'll get you to, you need to stay here and play rugby.
Mm.
Sorry, cricket.
Mm.
So I said, okay. But that winter, I used to play rugby on a Saturday. And then on Sunday morning, I used to get this phone call from Kepler. Let's go and meet down at the Nets. And every Sunday morning, I used to throw and bowl. And then... I mean, he probably won't ever listen to this podcast, but he had the poofy little arm, okay? So after throwing to him for nearly an hour and bowling to him for nearly an hour, I used to get half an hour of these little poofy throws at me, you know, like that. So but you had to stay in with the captain, you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
You had to stay with him. So this will definitely be Kepler.
I love that one. And I'm going to ask, there was a story about that Brett Schultz... spoke about where Kepler said to him, listen, when they went to Sri Lanka and just bowl crazy in the nets there and stuff. I mean, some of the stuff that like must have gone on there with Kepler as a captain. And we will. The biggest man in cricket, I'm saying this now, we will get to interview Kepler Wessels. He's in Australia,
right? He's in Australia, yeah.
We might have to go there or we'll find out when he's coming here.
Yeah, he'll be brilliant. Every now and again, we do drop in each other a message.
Yeah.
But he's good value.
Yeah.
He's very good value. He's got such a vast knowledge of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. Is he still involved in it all in Australia?
Do you know that he's a match referee in Australia?
Is he?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
He's a match referee. And his son's now, Ricky, can you believe it, is retired from cricket.
Wow,
and he's now just been recognized in the last month or so. He is now one of the first-class umpires.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I mean. So they're still very much involved in cricket.
Yeah.
Kef is still very involved in martial arts.
Yes.
He's still, when you look at on social media at him, he's still a mean machine. He is
incredible.
Still cut and flipping. Yeah, he's unbelievable.
That's
I think he's 66, 67 now.
Yeah.
He's still very, very, in very good shape. Eh?
Amazing. So. Yeah. We'll get Kepler on the show. And then the final item we've got here.
I mean,
we've got some nuts. Who was the nuttiest cricketer that you've ever played with or against? And who does that remind you of? Pringle. Merrick Pringle.
Pringle, yeah. He was nuts, eh? Merrick was nuts.
That's great, yeah.
Whatever he did, he was a fifth and fabulous bowler, unbelievable bowler.
And this, we'll post this online and we'll post this in the podcast as well, just in terms of the campaign that, so please, if you do get a delivery in April and from Take A Lot, please have a look at the package. And please, if you're a male, please go and all these items, we'll put them back in here. So we're not, all these items in the box itself are actually related to being a man and testing your testicles out and ensuring that you are that you're good to go. It does take 10 minutes. That's what the egg time is there for. The mirror is there for as well. And just take care of yourself as a male. Let's put the Nivea in there as well.
Is it there? I was going
to
use it.
No, this is all yours to keep. This is all yours to keep. We can drop it at Dave Richardson on there. We can drop the mirror off at Dave Richardson on the way out.
Yeah, listen, early detention is, I mean, I think that's what saved me. And when I say saved me, was definitely the reason why I was able to play cricket in a space of, I think it was 5.5 months, I was able to get back on a cricket field, you know. And like in the early days when I used to do quite a lot of talking for the Cancer Association, we didn't know about, you know, testing yourself and all that type of thing. It was just something that you never heard about, you know. And it was only because I got hit by a cricket ball, you know, in the groin area that I've realized that there was an issue, you know. and went to see a doctor in the UK, and he first treated me for like an infection, you know, like he said it might be an infection, and gave me antibiotics. And within a couple of months or a couple of weeks, there was no improvement.
Yeah.
And then I went back to him to see him. And he said to me, when are you going back to South Africa? And I said, well, I'm leaving for South Africa next week.
Mm.
So he said, I think you should see a doctor when you get home. I think he probably realized that there was something more serious, you know. So that's how I was detected, but not by testing myself.
Yeah.
You know, so, I really...
There was no awareness.
There was nothing, you know. Yeah. So, and so I was always... I actually was playing in... You remember Bruce Roberts? Bruce played cricket for Transvaal. He was actually in that sort of Mean Machine, just at the end of that Mean Machine.
Yeah.
He actually opened the batting in that Mean Machine, or batted three in that Mean Machine for a little while.
Mm.
And I was playing in his benefit game, funny enough, when I got hit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was just by fluke, really by fluke.
Is there, that whole period of your life and your career has come to define Dave Callaghan, the cricketer. Are you okay with that?
Yeah. I'm very comfortable with, I think it definitely made me a better person, in many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot more patient. I know that in the first half of my career, before all of this used to happen, I mean, obviously, I still get down on myself every now and again if I didn't make runs or didn't do well. But before that, I was quite sort of, it was never my fault. And I used to, throw my bat and my gloves and flip and, I was really sort of, And then when that sort of happened, I sort of realized, it's just nice to play cricket, and enjoy yourself and that type of thing, So I became a lot more relaxed afterwards, and enjoyed myself a bit more because you realize, I know that testicular cancer is very treatable and all that type of thing, but you still got cancer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's still going through your back of mind.
Yeah.
Is it going to spread? All that type of thing. I mean, still now I go for my blood tests or whatever it is, and I still get nervous, you know what I mean? To wait for the results, and it's 30 odd years, So, I do think it made me a little bit more relaxed towards my game, which if you look at my stats, I became a much better cricketer, not only because of my age, but because I was able to adapt and play better towards the end of my career because I was more relaxed about it.
That first game back, and that was a domestic game, if I'm not mistaken, what goes through your mind as you're walking out there?
Yeah. Can I go back a little bit? Yeah. Please. So before that game, I had absolutely no hair, and there was the World Cup side.
Yeah.
So Mark Rashmere was away, Kepler was away, Dave Richardson was away. They were all overseas. So we were destined to play a Currie Cup final up in Pretoria against Northerns, and EP wanted me back to play. So what they did was they played me against Northern Transvaal in a B-side game at St. George's. Okay. Gavin Horbler was bowling. Gavin Victor was batting on the side. I walked out to bat. First ball, Gavin Victor hits it straight back, hits Gavin's hand, and I got run out, can you believe it, without facing a ball. That was my first game back.
No worries. Okay.
So then they still picked me, to play in the side, and I go to in the final. Okay. I go to Pretoria playing Northerns. And first innings, I got Sylvester Clark nicked me off, got caught by Mike Haseman at third or fourth slip, for naught. All right. And then we had about 20 runs to get in the second innings to win the Currie Cup. And we lost a wicket and I went in. Mike Haseman, of all people, was bowling. I don't think he ever saw him bowl.
Yeah.
He bowled me a long hop. And I hooked it straight down mid-wicket for naught. So now I've got three noughts. Okay. But if you know the Northern Transvaal change room, it's got a massive bath.
Yes.
So we filled the water. Everyone's in there, champagne, and we're all going on. And then we had Louis Kuhn was there. And Louis was like serious at that stage. Excuse me, I would say it, but a serious little Dutchman from Paul. he was like, really, he ended up like really one of my, he's one of my closest friends. But He says, manne, ons moet die Here dank dat Kellis is saam met ons vanaand, you know, like.
Mm.
So anyway, in the bath in the corner was old Rudy Bryson.
Yes,
so Rudy says, hey, Louis, Kellis better ask the Lord for some runs soon, otherwise he's not going to be with us for much longer. you know, I've never,
that was
such classic, you know. So, then the next game after that, was against Transvaal.
Yeah.
Yeah, at St. George's, you know. And I can remember walking out to bat and I was just unbelievably emotional about this whole thing about walking out. And when I got to the wicket, I remember Clive Eckstein was bowling from the other side.
Mm.
And I had to actually take longer to sort of mark my, mark my in the
center,
crease. The crease. And I looked around and I just had my eyes. Every time I looked at Clive at the other side and the umpires, it was all so blurry. I would never been able to face that first ball. So it took me a long time before I was able to face that ball.
Yeah, at least it wasn't Franklin Stevenson.
No,
or one
it was,
of guys.
Thing was Clive. Thank you. Yeah. So, I ended up getting 61. And the crowd was unbelievable. Yeah. And we eventually won the game. So, and we progressed quite nicely in that year. I can't actually remember. I think we got to the semis and got knocked out. Yeah.
That, you then got a chance to come back to South African cricket and play international cricket again.
Mm.
Take us through that and how that came about and the feelings then.
Yeah, you know, I played from 92 to 95, had a up and down sort of career as a such, made that one big score of 169 against. But, you know, the game was so different in a way that if you batted like where we batted at 5 or 6, it was a slog at the end, you know what I mean? So you never faced many balls. You know, it's like almost I was playing a T20 game in a 50-over game, if you want to call it that, you know? So you never really got much opportunity. And then obviously I got that one opportunity to open and made some runs. And then...
don't gloss over that. We can do a whole podcast around that 169 innings.
And then we moved on. And then a couple of weeks later... we went to New Zealand and we got back from New Zealand and I was dropped, from the side.
Who was the coach at the time? Sorry.
Bob Woolman was coach.
Okay.
I was dropped from the side.
Mm.
And I remember I was playing cricket in England and I got a call from Ali Bacher to tell me that I've no longer needed as a contracted player.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know, I've just got 169 sort of thing, I was quite upset about it.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I said to him, Ali, I just want to ask you, you know, who's taking up the contract, you know? So he said, no, look, we're going on a little bit of a youth policy. We're going to sign on guys like Herschel Gibbs, Jacques Callis, Mark Boucher, and Ira Gang. Yeah, you know, I think they made a mistake. You know,
who's this callous kid?
Who's this callous kid? You know, like I don't think I actually don't even know if I played against him. I was involved on the tour to New Zealand when they played against EP, and I know that he got 100 against EP at St. George's while I was away. Mm. So a lot of the times when people ask me, I always say, you must understand one thing.
Mm.
Okay. I got dropped for the best player ever in the world. So I'm happy with it.
You'll take that.
I'll take that.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no,
it's
look
not so bad to be replaced.
No,
At least he went on and justified the decision.
No. Well, the first,
decision,
first few games I used to say, look, you see, he didn't make runs. I'm not like that. But yeah, he's the best player in the world by far. Eh?
But let's track because you tried to gloss over, but
so,
I'm not going to let you
And then I had a break of 5 years and I ended up being called back into the side in 2000. Mm. Hansi was omitted from the team for what that happened from, you know, that match fixing thing. And then I happened to get the phone call. Funny enough, the night before I'd already phoned Hansi just to chat to him and say to him, listen, is this all true? What's going on? You know, like, and I remember him, he said to me, Kellis, I can't talk to you now. He said, I think my phone's been tapped. But I will have a beer one day. Mm. And unfortunately, that beer never, ever happened. The following day, I actually arrived at St. George's because I had the sports shop there at the time. And I arrived, pulled up in exactly the same spot as where I'd phoned him the day before. And it was Dave Emsley on the phone, phoning me. And he said to me, Dave, where are you? I said, well, I've just pulled up at St. George's. So he said, the convener of selectors is going to phone you now. You need to get to Durban.
Sure.
So I got in the car, raced back to my home, packed all my kit. I had the old blazer. Yeah. I had brown shoes. They were all wearing black shoes. Everything was different. In 5 years, so much had changed.
Yeah.
And then I raced up to, flew up to Durban, yeah. And I arrived there, and I remember when I got there, when I got to the ground, to the hotel, I was taken up the back to the room, and I got there. There was the suite that Hansi was in. His clothes were all lying in the corner there. He had, there was five Olsen beers standing on the on the middle table.
Mm.
His bed hadn't been slept on, and it was quite airy actually. Mm. And the manager said to me, "Listen, it was Gulam, I remember Gulam. Yeah, he said to me, listen, yeah, just stay around. I'll call you later. And I watched the upstairs, watched the press conference downstairs till it was over. And then I was called out and then obviously announced that I'd taken Nancy's position. So, yeah, I've got a little piece of paper like this that I kept. I don't know what made me do it. You know those little Holiday Inn pieces of paper? Yeah. And on on there, Hansi had written a few notes, you know. Mm. And number one was Bertha, his wife. Number two on the note was Peter P., Peter Pollock. Number three was Ali. And Ali was actually entertaining Malcolm Speed at a game reserve up in Durban at the time. Because you can see that there's a number of numbers that on there that is obviously trying to track him down.
Mm.
And then on the back of the piece of paper was Ray McCauley.
Oh, wow.
So those are the four people that that Hansi phoned that evening to say, listen, yeah, you know, I'm in trouble, you know. Right. So I took that piece of paper. I've kept it here. I've still got it here. I arrived in England just after that to play cricket. I was offered thousands of pounds for this piece of paper.
Imagine.
Yeah. But it's something that, you know, I treasure, you know. Myself and Hansi, we had a benefit together down in, at the same time, when I had my benefit, Ife, we had a golf day together. He played for Norden and I played for Rochdale in the later leagues.
Mm.
We used to train together, practice together. Yeah, so this was, for me, was a major, major upheaval. I mean, I really didn't expect to see it. I still don't know when it started or what, you know, how it happened. Mm. I've got one or two stories from one or two guys, but I choose really to try and ignore as much of it as possible. Mm.
Do you believe things happen for a reason? And do you believe that your career and things that happened in your career
were meant to happen?
Okay.
So unfortunately that little spell was just one series against Australia at a very late stage of my career, you know. I remember the last game I played, and I knew it was going to be it was definitely my last game. And I think it was in Cape Town. And we were playing in Cape Town, we were playing against Australia. And in the warm-up, I tweaked my hammy. Jesus, I tell you now, there was no ways. I could feel it, a little lump forming here, you know, there was no ways I was going to give this opportunity. If I walked in and had a physio, got the, old rubbish. Yeah, you're right. I said, no, I'm fine. They strapped it up.
Yeah.
I made sure that I played that game because I knew it was going to be my last one. Yeah. No, you just have a feeling when it's your last one, you know.
Let's talk about the 169 game because that became synonymous with your career.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
just take us through that knock. It was obviously, we've spoken about you opened that innings, which you never did before. Take us through it.
Yeah, so it was, as I sort of briefly mentioned earlier, I was going along in my career, making runs for EP on a regular basis, batting at four, and doing well, you know, like but every time I'd gone into the South African setup, I made a couple of 40s, a couple of 20s, but as I said to you, the game was changed. You know, you sort of had to really give it a bash at the end. You never got that long time to sort of, and if you did get a long time, it was on a poor wicket, you know what I mean? So I never got an opportunity to sort of, like, I never felt like I got an opportunity to actually display what I was, you know, what I could do, you know? And I knew time, you just get that feeling, you know, in a team sport that time is running out, you know, you need to perform. And out of the blue, I think Gary was having a bad run. Gary Kirsten was having a bad run. Probably the only one he ever did. But anyway, the night before the game, Hansie came past me and he said to me, listen, would you like to open tomorrow? And I said, yeah. You know, I mean, I've always enjoyed, I've made lots of runs at Centurion.
Yeah.
And I love the Centurion wicket. Yeah. And I said, no, definitely. I'd love the opportunity. And that was it. We arrived at the ground, started warming. So just before the ground, started warming up. Hansie calls me aside with Bob Wilmer and said, listen, you're going to open today. Okay. So anyway, we won the toss and elected to bat. And before I know it, I've got the pads on, you know. So we go out to bat and Andrew Hudson was my partner. He took the first ball of the innings and he got one outside. And this is, you know, the game is made of just so small margins all the time.
Yeah.
So he got a ball outside off from, I think it was Pringle or Danny Morrison or whatever. He's got a ball outside off stump and he cut it and he got caught at third man. Mm. Okay. Then I think Daryl came in and he got a one and then I was on the striker's end and I got exactly the same ball as Andrew, but I cut it 2 yards left of the fielder and it bounced and went for four. Okay. So, you know, like I always look at it and go, gee, it could have been, I could have got caught out there, you know? Yeah. And then, you know, as the innings developed, I felt it more at home and, you know, we go along and I got to 50 and then I almost like say to myself, you know, I've done enough here.
Yeah.
You know, like, I might get a couple more games. You know what I mean? You know, and then I got closer to 100. I thought, I can get 100. Yeah. You know, like I could get 100. If you ever watch the video, I'll go back to that 100. At 100, in those days, guys used to run onto the field.
With the beer and stuff.
And I remember this guy came running on, I think it was 100 or 150, I can't remember. And he had a big 2 liter thing of Coke, okay? And I just wanted this Coke.
Yeah.
And that's all I needed. And I grabbed it like this and brandy and Coke.
Yeah, brandy and
Coke. Brandy and Coke. I also, let's say, Coke with brandy, you know what I mean? It was so strong, okay? Anyway, I had a good sip of it and then gave it back and he ran off the field. So that's, I got to 100.
Yeah.
And then moved on. And then I was doing like the sweep of the spinners.
That iconic shot.
Yeah, I was leaning on the back foot and hitting it over midweek.
Yeah.
I could, from 100 onwards to 169, I could do what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it's, you probably get that in your career, you know, four or five times in your life that you get that opportunity where you can just hit anything that you want, wherever you want.
In the zone.
Yeah. Got to the 169 not out. And you never really understand until later afterwards what it did for me. You know, it was like, it was amazing. So after the game, so now we all, funny enough, we played on the Sunday. The next Monday morning, we were all playing in Currie Cup games around the country. So we had to fly home.
Yeah.
To PE, and you want to talk about how hard Kepler was. So all the guys left the change room because I was doing all these press interviews and all that type of thing. And then on the way home, I got a lift home with Ghulam, and he said to me, and I wasn't thinking, he said to me, "Dave, do you want to go for supper? Come to my house for supper."
Mm.
And obviously, you know, they don't have alcohol, eh?
Yeah.
So anyway, I went for supper and met his family and everything because everybody had gone home.
Yeah.
They'd all disappeared. Anyway, I had supper with them and then I got back to the hotel, and the only guys in the bar downstairs were the New Zealand guys. So I went and had a beer with them and then went to bed.
I'm assuming the beers were on them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I overslept. Okay. The next morning, and I got up, and when I woke up, I saw this bus leaving for the airport.
Oh, shit.
And when the bus left, like, I tried to get a taxi, and I missed my flight. But I could get a flight half an hour later, which meant that I was going to arrive in PE at about 9:45, game starting at 10. So I'd be half an hour late for the game. So I phoned Kepler. I said, "Kepler, this, you know, this is what's happened. I'm on my way.
Bad first.
Don't bother."
Don't bother.
That's how it is. Just don't bother.
That's so good.
I think he was under the impression that I had such a big night.
Yeah.
The night
you
before.
Were hungover. Yeah.
Hungover. So don't bother.
That's ruthless.
Yeah.
Eh?
Yeah.
That's probably the most Kepler story.
So I got a flight. Took the flight. Yeah. Arrived back in PE. Went to the ground thinking that it was joking.
Yeah.
Okay. When I got in the change room, there was
the drinks to carry.
Yeah. You're not playing, but
that was so good.
Yeah,
Dave. You obviously, I mean, we could talk for hours, but you stayed involved in cricket once you were done playing, and you actually carried on playing a little bit in the Vets game. That's why you Louis couldn't still play
still
well.
Still players, he's still playing now. Recently, yeah. Yeah, so I stayed active in the game for a long time, manager of, or chairman of Old Grey Cricket Club, coached at the school, okay, school for about 7-8 years. And then I left probably 2000. I think COVID really put a pay to all those sort of things, you know, and obviously moved out here and that. So I'm not as active as I would like to be in the game, or so I would like to, but it's a bit more difficult out here, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I still show a big interest. I still watch every single cricket game on TV, you know.
Amazing.
What I mean? It's just I love the game. It's done so much for me. And yeah, it builds character, you know. Yeah. I think it's just one of those games that you're so synonymous with life, you know. I always say to the kids when I coach them, I say, you know, guys, if you're It's actually an individual game within a team. And if you take the individual and he does well, the team does well. You know what I mean? You know, so, you know, if you as a batsman, or if you do well as a batsman, number one, two, three, or four, okay, your team benefits. You know what I mean? And that's what it's like, you know. I always just say, when I used to do these sales meetings and that at work and that, I should always say to people, you know, being a salesman's almost like being a batsman. So when you get out a nought, it's the same as when you make a cold call and you get
slammed down on the
on the phone. The next time you pick up the phone, you're not so confident.
Yeah.
In batting terms, when you walk out of the wicket, you're not so confident, you know.
Yeah.
And after about the third duck, you know, you decide this is, you know.
But that big score is coming.
Yeah, that big one's coming.
And it keeps you coming back for more.
Yeah.
Dave, I know you've got a golf day this afternoon, which is great, and we don't want to take up too much more of your time. We've got a final section here called the declaration. Just some quick fire questions. Best bowler you've ever faced?
And I faced I would have to say Malcolm Marshall, probably
Best ground you've ever played at?
Best ground. I'd have to say St. George's. Yeah, I mean, St. George's for me was everything. You know, it was made every. If you want a picturesque ground, I would probably one of the English fields, Arundel Castle, would be a picturesque ground that I played on. It's not a county ground. But they do play county cricket
ground,
there, but it's a beautiful ground. Yeah.
Big question now: Open Championship or GM Bats?
Open Championship or GM Bats?
preference.
Now at this stage in my life, I would go for Open Championship.
Love it. That iconic bat of yours, eh? Surely you've got one in stock somewhere.
Yeah, I've got a bat at, funny enough, I got a bat at, in storage.
Okay,
because
nice.
We moved from PE.
Yeah.
And I took it out the other day. It was cleaned up for me many years ago, probably 10 or 15 years ago. But the edges, I can't believe it, are like this.
Look at the modern bats now.
And you look at the modern, I've got edges like this.
Yeah.
And the sad thing about it is the rubber handle's perished.
When we interviewed Adrian Cope, he said that he threw his bat in his fire and made some firewood with it.
No, I've got a few bats there. The other part is that I remember in my career, I used to collect signature bats, you know, my teams I played against.
Yeah. Oh, wow, okay, nice.
You might as well give them to all the kids and let them use them, because the signatures of... You can't see who they are anymore. They've all disappeared.
There's some great names on there, I'm sure. The most underrated player you've ever played with or against?
Yeah, I think if you... Flum was a great team man. Unfortunately, him and Kepler didn't see eye to eye, and he moved on, but earlier than he should have moved on.
Mm.
So from a local point of view, I would have to go with Flummy. He could have added so much more to EP for a longer.
Nice. Current cricketer you love watching play, and I'd like to make this South African first, and then we can talk international. But South African player.
Oh, I'm going to upset one of them anyway. but I'm going to have to say Tristan Stubbs would be one, and then obviously very, very close behind them would be Matthew, because I've been involved in a little bit of their careers. So.
International guy?
International? Funny enough, I still love watching Joe Root. I think he's just the way he plays, how he builds an innings. You know, I'm still from the old school. I still like to watch Test cricket. I would say Joe Root, yeah. I always ask the players of today. you get the, you made a brilliant 18. In my day, a brilliant 18.
You would have got,
you know what I mean?
You would have got smashed.
You know what I mean? I read these reports and a magnificent 15 or something. You know, like,
it's about impact now. You can be coming for four balls, score 18, and you play of the match, which is mind-blowing.
Yeah. I remember talking to Tristan Stubbs a few years ago, I think after he went to his first World Cup and he came back. He explained to me that he went to Australia for 6 weeks or whatever it was for the World Cup, or a month for the World Cup, I can't remember. And in matches alone, I think he faced 12 balls.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm going, that's a long way to face 12 balls.
That's a million rand a ball. Dave, it's been an absolute honor to be here. Thank you for having us in your beautiful home. It's a beautiful, naturally windy day. Nothing changes. It's been amazing to chat, and really thank you. And keep contributing to the game. You've done well with Matthew Bredsker and Tristan Stubbs and contributed to them and the next generation. So thanks for still contributing.
Thank you.
It's been an amazing chat. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.